So in 1927, the United States Supreme Court authorized the forced sterilization of a young woman named Carrie Buck.
Right.
And the most terrifying part of this whole history isn't just that the highest court in the land sanctioned such a, well, a profound violation.
Yeah, it really is about why they did it.
Exactly. It's why they didn't frame it as a punishment. They didn't frame it as an act of malice or hatred or anything like that. They framed it as an act of public health.
Which is just chilling.
It is. They literally did it in the name of healing society.
And I mean, it remains one of the darkest, most cautionary testaments to what actually happens when we treat a human civilization like a biological body.
Right, like a body that has a sickness.
Exactly. A body that supposedly needs to be cured of its so-called pathogens. Because when you apply the strict logic of medicine to the messy reality of politics and human life, the results can be just catastrophic.
And that is exactly where we are starting today. Because right now in our modern world, we are kind of obsessed with this idea that our society is sick and desperately needs to be cured.
We really are.
So welcome to today's deep dive. It is Friday, August 28th, 2026, and we are embarking on this massive, really vital journey into a brand new publication by Dr. Bechara Sesheli.
It's an incredible piece of work.
It really is. It's titled The Missing Grammar of Modern Civilization. And I just want to say, whether you are commuting to work right now or prepping for a board meeting, or you're just insanely curious about how our world actually functions beneath the surface, this text is going to fundamentally change how you view the institutions around you.
Yeah, because the core premise we are unpacking today is this massive paradox. Modern society has reached an absolute apex of technological and specialized capability.
We are so capable.
Right, but at the exact same time, we seem completely paralyzed when it comes to solving systemic overlapping crises, like climate change or inequality or these massive public health emergencies.
So we are going to explore why our institutions are suffering from what the author calls a grammar deficit.
Which is such a fascinating term.
It is. And we're also going to dive deep into the terrifying historical baggage of that word, healing.
Yeah, that part gets really dark.
It does. We'll look at why the urge to heal civilization might actually be the fastest route to destroying it. And finally, we're going to explore how artificial intelligence is sitting right at the center of all of this.
AI isn't just another tech trend here.
No, not at all. It is the historical hinge. It will either amplify our blind spots until they destroy us, or it might just serve as the infrastructure we need to save ourselves.
Because the main argument of this text is that civilization is not an organism. It's not a body with a fever that we can just perfectly cure.
Right.
It is a highly complex system, and that system must learn to recognize and repair its own injuries without devolving into a dictatorship that forces everyone to live the exact same way.
Okay, let's unpack this, because I want to start with this paradox of modern capability. It really is baffling when you stop and think about
it. It is.
You look around, and we literally have rovers driving on Mars. We can edit genes. We have these global supply chains that are optimized down to the literal millisecond.
We are incredibly powerful.
We are. And yet we feel completely stuck. Why are we so capable and yet so utterly incapable at the exact same time?
Well, to understand that, we have to look at a concept called functional differentiation.
Functional differentiation. Okay.
Right. It's a massive historical shift observed by these foundational sociologists, thinkers like Emil Durkheim, Max Weber, Karl Polanyi, and Nicholas Luhmann.
Okay, the heavy hitters.
Exactly. They all recognized that modern society didn't achieve its immense power by just getting generally smarter across the board.
We didn't just collectively level up our brains.
No, we achieved our power by breaking ourselves apart into highly specialized, isolated domains.
Right, we carved the world up into slices.
Exactly. I
Yeah.
mean, think about how a pre-modern society might have operated. Religion, politics, economics, and law were often entirely fused together.
Right, like the king was in charge of everything.
Yes. The sovereign dictated what was true, what was legal, and what was profitable all at the exact same time. But modernity shattered that. We separated things out.
We separated into specialized spheres: science, law, medicine, economics, politics. And here is the genius of it. Each of those domains developed its own internal logic, its own selective rationality.
Meaning they basically judge success by completely different scorecards.
Precisely. So science evaluates the world based on what is true or empirically warranted.
Okay.
Law evaluates the world based on what is valid or legally actionable. Economics evaluates the world based on what is profitable or priced. And medicine diagnoses what is pathological versus what is healthy.
I want to make sure you, listening right now, can picture exactly what this looks like in your daily life. Because it's everywhere.
It really is.
Think about your own workplace, especially if you work in a, you know, a mid to large company. You have a marketing department, a legal department, and a finance department.
Classic setup. Right. And the marketing team's sole rationality is, how do we maximize attention and clicks? That's their whole world.
Yeah.
Then the legal department's sole rationality is, how do we minimize our liability to absolute zero? And finance is just looking at the quarterly budget, asking, how do we cut spending?
And they are all operating completely independently.
Exactly. Every single department can be doing its specific job absolutely perfectly. Marketing gets the clicks, legal avoids a lawsuit, finance cuts the budget.
But the outcome can still be a disaster.
Completely. Because they are totally isolated and they aren't speaking the same language, the company launches a terrible product, alienates its customers, and goes bankrupt. Everyone succeeded in their silo, but the whole enterprise failed.
And now, take that exact dynamic and project it onto the entire planet.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is exactly what the sociologist Ulrich Beck called organized irresponsibility.
Organized irresponsibility.
Yeah. It is the defining feature of our time. We gain incredible capability within these specific domains, but we completely lose cross-domain accountability.
That phrase is haunting because it's just so accurate. Let's ground this in the specific example the text uses, because it really blew my mind when I read it.
The carbon emission example.
Yes. Let's look at a massive corporation emitting huge amounts of carbon into the atmosphere. How does our functionally differentiated world actually process that single action?
Well, the economic domain looks at the action and says, this energy source is cheap and it maximizes shareholder returns. It is highly profitable.
So according to the logic of economics, it's a massive success.
Right. Then the legal domain looks at it. And maybe the corporation lobbied for a specific loophole, or they are operating in a jurisdiction with weak environmental laws.
So the lawyers say, hey, no statutes are being violated. This is legally permitted.
Exactly. So according to the law, it's a success. Then the engineering and technical domain looks at the extraction and combustion process.
And they say, look, we are operating machinery at 99% efficiency.
Technical success. Then the political domain looks at it and says, well, regulating this would cause job losses in a swing state right before an election, so we are just going to defer action.
Political success, or, I mean, at least political survival.
Right. So four major pillars of human society are looking at this massive carbon emission and essentially giving it a gold star.
But at the exact same moment, the medical domain is looking at asthma rates just skyrocketing in the local community.
And the ecological domain is watching the polar ice caps melt and biodiversity completely collapse.
And this is the tragedy of organized irresponsibility. Every single subsystem can generate a report that says, hey, everything is functioning perfectly.
While the larger pattern of life becomes entirely unlivable.
Exactly. We have built a world where it is basically no one's specific job to look the whole board. The economic metrics look fantastic. The legal compliance is flawless. The engineers get their bonuses.
But the people are chronically sick and the ecosystem is dying.
It's like having a team of the most brilliant surgeons, engineers, and lawyers in the world. And they're all operating on a single patient.
That's a great way to put it.
But they don't speak the same language. They're in completely different rooms. And they only get paid if they successfully use their specific tool.
Right.
So the surgeon successfully cuts. The engineer successfully runs the life support machine. The lawyer successfully defends the hospital's liability. They all did their jobs perfectly.
But because they couldn't communicate, the patient bled out on the table.
That is the crisis of modernity in a nutshell.
And this brings us to a really difficult catch-22 involving liberal pluralism.
Okay, let's get into this.
Because when we talk about this extreme fragmentation, the immediate reaction is often, well, let's just put someone in charge to force all these departments to work together.
Right, like we need a boss for the whole planet.
But as a society, we deeply value liberal pluralism. We do not want a single dictator, what the text calls a sovereign council, forcing one monolithic version of the good on everyone.
Right. We don't want a king returning to tell the scientists what they are allowed to discover, or telling the economists what people are allowed to buy, just to enforce a unified vision.
Because the separation of these domains actually gave us freedom. It meant that a scientific fact couldn't be outlawed just because it made a politician look bad.
That makes total sense. Liberal pluralism is a massive historical achievement. It allows people to have the freedom to live wildly different kinds of lives alongside each other.
It is. But here is the catch-22. This neutral pluralism, where the government just tries to stay out of the way and let the silos operate, completely fails when dealing with interdependent threats.
Because you can't be neutral on climate change.
No, you can't. And you cannot be neutral when an algorithm is deciding who gets approved for housing and who gets denied. When threats cross boundaries, our neutral silos just freeze up.
We need a way for the surgeon, the engineer, and the lawyer to talk to each other without one of them becoming a dictator.
Yes. We need what the author calls a grammar.
A grammar.
Not a single unified worldview that everyone is forced to adopt, but a shared language, a syntax to translate the injury and the responsibility across these rigid boundaries.
Wait, hold on. This is where I found myself naturally pushing back as I was reading this part of the text.
Oh, really? What part?
Because we're sitting here talking about how modern society is fragmented and desperately needs a connective grammar. But hasn't humanity already figured this out?
What do you mean?
Well, if you go to any wellness retreat or even, you know, some corporate leadership seminars these days, you hear constantly about ancient wisdom.
Yeah.
People say, oh, we just need to return to indigenous ways of knowing, or we need to adopt Buddhist mindfulness, or look at Greek philosophies of harmony.
Right.
Didn't these ancient cultures already understand how everything is connected? Like, why don't we just use their frameworks to fix our modern silos?
It is incredibly tempting to do that. And the text actually spends a lot of time examining this exact impulse.
I feel like everyone is looking to the past for answers right now.
They are. And the author looks at Greek environmental medicine, for example, like how Hippocrates linked human health directly to the air, the water, and the political life of the city.
Right.
It looks at Confucian cultivation, which draws a straight line from the moral character of the individual to the stability of the state. It examines Buddhist frameworks of suffering, Abrahamic traditions of justice, and indigenous relationality.
So they did have a grammar that connected itself, society, and nature.
Yes, they did.
So why can't we just copy-paste that into our world?
Because the author issues a very strict, severe warning against doing that. Specifically, they warn against two traps, perennialism and romantic reversal.
Okay, let's break those down. What exactly is the danger of perennialism?
Perennialism is this habit we have in the modern West of basically browsing through history like a buffet.
Oh, I know exactly what you mean.
We cherry-pick a phrase from a 2,500-year-old Buddhist text, mash it up with a quote from a 19th-century indigenous leader, sprinkle in some ancient Greek philosophy.
And we remove all of them from their actual historical context.
Exactly. And then we declare that we've discovered one universal ancient doctrine of wholeness.
The ultimate philosophical smoothie.
That is a great way to put it. And it is completely intellectually dishonest. The author is very clear that we cannot do this. We also have to avoid romantic reversal.
Which is what, exactly?
It's the tendency to treat our modern world as purely broken and fragmented while romanticizing the past as an era of pure, perfect integration.
Because the past was definitely not a perfect, harmonious utopia.
Far from it. Let's look closely at those Greek analogies for a second.
Yeah, let's do it.
When ancient Greek philosophers compared the political city-state to a biological organism, saying the city is like a body, that holistic language was often used to justify incredibly rigid, brutal social hierarchies.
Wait, really? How?
Think about it. If the city is a body, someone has to be the brain, right?
Right.
That's either the elite, the ruling class, and someone else has to be the hands or the feet.
Mm.
And feet get dirty and feet are expendable.
Oh, wow.
Holistic language was used to naturalize slavery and extreme inequality. Because if you are the foot, you can't complain. You're just serving the health of the body.
That completely flips the script.
Yeah.
I never thought about it that way. If society is a body, you are basically locked into your biological role.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just decide you want to be the brain if you were born to be a toe.
Right. And consider the Buddhist concept of liberation from suffering, or dukkha.
Okay.
When it was formulated, it was a profound path of personal spiritual liberation. It was about individual enlightenment and monastic practice.
It wasn't about running a government.
Exactly. It was not originally designed as a blueprint for modern public policy or a framework for how a sprawling administrative state should regulate global supply chains. When we rip it out of its spiritual context and try to apply it to a tax code, it loses its meaning entirely.
And the text gets really emphatic when it comes to indigenous knowledge. This is a point I want to make sure you, the listener, really sit with, because you see this happening everywhere today.
It is so prevalent right now.
Corporations and governments just love to talk about indigenous relationality. this beautiful idea that we are in reciprocal relationships with the land, the rivers, the animals,
yes,
in future generations.
Yes.
But they just want the philosophy, right?
Yes. And this is where the warning in the text is most urgent. Indigenous peoples have profound, deeply place-specific legal and relational orders. But the text explicitly notes that extracting this conceptual idea of relationality from Indigenous peoples, while simultaneously ignoring their political jurisdiction.
Ignoring their sovereignty.
Yeah. Exactly. Ignoring their sovereignty and the brutal ongoing legacy of colonial dispossession is just another form of domination.
It's essentially saying, hey, we love your spiritual connection to the trees. We're going to put a quote about it on the wall of our corporate headquarters.
Yep.
But by the way, we're keeping your land. We are ignoring your treaties. And you have absolutely no political rights here.
It's philosophical extraction. You cannot separate Indigenous knowledge from Indigenous jurisdiction. The author points directly to the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples here,
emphasizing that any engagement has to be grounded in self-determination.
Yes. Free, prior, and informed consent. So, to answer your original question, no. We cannot just appropriate ancient or Indigenous wisdom as a plug-and-play fix for our functionally differentiated, hyper-industrialized modern world.
So if we can't use them as a direct blueprint, what is the point of looking backward at all? I mean, what can we take from these traditions?
We take the motifs.
The motifs.
The genuine continuity across thousands of years of human history is that communities, no matter where or when they lived, have repeatedly asked the same enduring questions.
Like what?
Like, how are the moral order, our physical living conditions, and our concepts of justice inextricably linked? When a relationship within the community is damaged, how do we actually restore it?
Okay, so we take those profound questions.
We take the questions, but we recognize that we have to build a distinctly modern reconstruction to answer them.
Because the ancient Greeks didn't have to figure out how to regulate high-frequency trading algorithms.
No, they did not.
Or navigate the ethical dilemmas of synthetic biology, or deal with global atmospheric carbon parts per million.
Exactly. We need a modern synthesis for a modern reality.
Okay, so ancient wisdom isn't our silver bullet.
Mm.
But as I was reading further, I realized, wait, aren't our modern specialized fields already trying to solve this problem on their own?
What do you mean?
Like, I know medicine today isn't just looking at germs in a microscope anymore. Surely the doctors have figured out that poverty causes disease. Aren't the silos already starting to talk to each other?
Yes, and this is actually a really hopeful part of the analysis. The specialized silos are waking up.
That's good news.
They are hitting a ceiling within their own domains, and they are realizing that they absolutely cannot operate in a vacuum anymore. There is a massive contemporary convergence happening across these fields.
Let's trace that convergence, because the text tells this incredible story about how medicine started to expand its vision. It goes all the way back to 1848.
With Rudolf Virchow.
Yes. With a physician named Rudolf Virchow. I had never heard of him before this, but his story is just fascinating.
Virchow is a legendary figure in public health. In 1848, there was a devastating outbreak of typhus in Upper Silesia, which was a very poor region of Prussia at the time.
And people were dying in droves.
You were. So the Prussian government sent Virchow, who was this brilliant young physician and pathologist, to investigate the epidemic and figure out how to stop the bacteria.
They wanted him to act as the classic specialized doctor. Go in, find the pathogen, prescribe a chemical, and leave.
Exactly. But Virchow goes to Upper Silesia, and he observes the horrific conditions.
What does he see?
He sees extreme poverty, malnutrition, a total lack of housing, brutal labor conditions, and the complete disenfranchisement of the Polish-speaking minority by the Prussian elite. And when he writes his official report, he doesn't just ask for more medicine. His prescription is radically expansive. He essentially traces the biological disease directly back to the political and economic structure.
He famously said something like, medicine is a social science, and politics is nothing else but medicine on a large scale.
That's the exact quote.
He literally prescribed democracy, education, and better wages as the cure for typhus.
Because he recognized that you can treat the fever all you want, but if you send the patient back into a freezing, damp, starving environment governed by an oppressive regime, the disease will just return.
It's treating the symptom, not the cause.
Right. Virchow's work planted the seeds for what we now call the social determinants of health. And this evolved over a century later into George Engel's biopsychosocial model.
Which did what?
It formally challenged the idea that illness is just a mechanical breakdown of a biological machine. It argued that to understand a patient's health, you have to understand their biology, their psychological state, and their social environment as one interconnected web.
So medicine is expanding its view. It's looking outside its silo.
Yeah.
And we see this same exact convergence happening in ecology. Right?
Absolutely. The ecological sciences have realized they can't just study a single forest in total isolation.
Right.
We now have the rise of movements like One Health, which is a framework recognized by the WHO and the CDC. It explicitly links human health to the health of animals and the shared environment.
Like if you destroy a bat habitat through deforestation, you drastically increase the likelihood of a zoonotic virus jumping to humans.
Exactly. It's all connected.
And the text also mentions planetary health, which looks at the life support systems of the entire Earth. It notes a terrifying update from 2023, which states that 6 out of 9 planetary boundaries have already been transgressed.
These are the critical boundaries like climate change, biosphere integrity, and freshwater change that keep the Earth stable and habitable for humanity.
So the scientists are saying, we can't just look at local pollution anymore. We have to govern the entire planetary system.
Yes. And it's not just the hard sciences. The deep dive outlines how justice and economics are converging, too.
Yeah, look at peace research. A scholar named Johann Galtung completely changed how we think about conflict. He shifted the focus away from what he called negative peace.
Negative peace is just the absence of war or the absence of direct physical violence. It's a ceasefire.
But a ceasefire doesn't mean things are good.
No, not at all.
You could have a heavily oppressed population living under a brutal police state where no one is actively shooting at the moment. That's negative peace.
Galtung said we need positive peace.
Positive peace.
Yes. Positive peace is the presence of social arrangements that actively cultivate equity, justice, and human flourishing. It asks, do our institutions diminish human potential or do they elevate it?
It's a much wider lens.
It is. And we see this reflected in the restorative justice movement today, which focuses on repairing the harm done to relationships and meeting the needs of victims.
Rather than just locking rule breakers in a cage to satisfy the legal code. And economics is doing this as well. The paper brings up the Nobel laureate Amartya Sen and his capability approach.
Yes, Sen's work is crucial here.
For decades, economists just looked at GDP. Did the line go up? Yes. Then the country is doing great.
But Sen argued that we shouldn't judge economic success just by total wealth or resources. We have to look at the substantive freedoms people actually possess to live a life they value.
Right. If a country has a massive GDP, but half the population lacks the education or healthcare necessary to participate in society, then that economic system is failing.
The capability approach asks, are people actually capable of flourishing?
Okay, so let's take a breath and look at where we are. Medicine, ecology, justice, economics, all these massive, powerful silos are waking up.
They are.
They are expanding their vision. They're reaching out toward each other. So, I mean, problem solved, right? If everyone is looking at the big picture, we should be fine.
And here is where it gets really interesting, because the text pulls the rug out from under us.
It really does.
Because despite this incredible historic convergence of all these fields, we still do not have integration.
Why not? I mean, if they all know they need each other, what is stopping them?
Because convergence is not the same thing as integration.
Okay, explain that.
Let me give you a scenario. Imagine a coastal city that is transitioning away from a massive coal-fired power plant. They put a public health official, a labor economist, an ecologist, and a human rights lawyer in a room to design the transition plan.
It sounds like the perfect progressive think tank. They all care about the big picture.
It is a great start. But the moment they sit down, the problem of the grammar deficit just reappears immediately.
How so?
Because they all still retain their distinct professional objects and metrics. The economist is looking at a spreadsheet of job losses and energy costs. The ecologist is looking at a model of carbon parts per million and local water toxicity.
And the health official is looking at longitudinal data on lung cancer rates.
Right. They are all sitting at the same table, but they absolutely do not have a shared syntax to translate their data into a unified decision.
I see what you mean. The economist says, hey, shutting this plant down immediately will bankrupt 40% of this town and cause immense suffering.
And the health official says, keeping this plant open for another 5 years will cause 500 excess cases of asthma and cancer, causing immense suffering.
How do they weigh a bankrupt family against a child with asthma? Who decides the exchange rate between economic ruin and biological disease?
Exactly. Without a shared grammar, the conversation just devolves into a power struggle. Whoever has the most political leverage or the most funding wins the argument while the other domains are ignored.
Yeah.
They need a framework of mutual answerability. They need a way to translate across these incompatible databases and professional languages without erasing the validity of the other perspectives.
And this shared syntax, this desperately needed framework to connect the silos, is what the author calls civilizational healing.
That is the project.
Okay, civilizational healing. On its face, it sounds beautiful. It sounds like exactly what we need. Let's heal the divides. Let's heal the planet. Let's heal our institutions. But before the author lets us embrace this concept, they force us to walk through fire. Because the text takes a very sharp, very dark turn here.
We have to look at how incredibly dangerous the word healing can be when applied to a society.
The author argues that healing is arguably the most dangerous metaphor in political history.
It really is.
Hold on. You're telling me that healing, the thing that doctors do to save lives, the thing therapists do to mend trauma, is a dangerous political metaphor? That sounds completely backwards to me.
I know, it sounds counterintuitive.
How do you get from a doctor curing a fever to a political nightmare?
You get there by taking the logic of the clinic and applying it directly to the state.
Okay, walk me through that.
If you view a human civilization as a single biological body, you inevitably start looking for pathogens to cut out.
Oh.
Think about how a human immune system works. When it identifies a foreign invader, a virus or a bacteria, it attacks it and destroys it. When a surgeon sees a necrotic limb or a tumor, their job is to excise it to save the rest of the body.
Right, to cut it out.
Now, take that exact logic and apply it to a society. If the nation is the body, who becomes the tumor? Who is classified as the pathogen?
Oh, wow. Once you frame someone as a disease, you aren't just disagreeing with them politically anymore. You are medically obligated to eliminate them for the survival of the host.
Exactly. The historical breakdown in the text is absolutely brutal. It traces how, in the late 19th and 20th centuries, the vocabularies of biology and social policy merged into the horrific pseudoscience of eugenics.
Right.
Francis Galton coined the term, and he framed it entirely as the medical improvement of the human population. It was sold as a grand project of civilizational healing.
And this wasn't just some fringe theory in a dark corner of history. This brings us back to the story I mentioned at the very beginning of the show.
Buck v. Bell.
The 1927 U.S. Supreme Court case. For those who aren't familiar with this, it is widely considered one of the most shameful, horrifying moments in American legal history.
It is essential that we look closely at this case because it perfectly illustrates the weaponization of the healing metaphor.
So the state of Virginia had passed a law allowing the forced sterilization of inmates in state institutions who were deemed socially inadequate.
Right.
They wanted to sterilize a young woman named Carrie Buck, claiming she was, quote, feeble-minded and promiscuous, which, by the way, was entirely false. She had been raped by a relative of her foster family and institutionalized just to hide the shame.
It's horrifying.
It is. But her case goes all the way to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And the court, led by Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., ruled 8-1 in favor of the state. They ruled that she could be sterilized against her will.
And listen to the exact language Justice Holmes used in his written opinion, because this is the key.
Yeah.
He didn't say, we are punishing this woman. He used the language of public health. He wrote that it is better for all the world if society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind, comparing it to compulsory vaccination.
Comparing it to a vaccine.
Yes. And he famously concluded with the chilling phrase, 3 generations of imbeciles are enough.
He compared cutting into a woman's body and ending her reproductive capacity to getting a vaccine. He framed the sacrifice of a vulnerable human being as a necessary medical intervention for the public welfare.
The Supreme Court literally used the language of societal improvement and healing to authorize state violence.
Unbelievable.
And the lesson the author wants us to take from this isn't just that eugenics was scientifically fraudulent. The deeper lesson is that the vocabulary of healing possesses this terrifying power to launder authority.
To launder authority.
Yes. It can transform vicious political prejudice, racism, and classism into what looks like a neutral, objective, technical necessity. The targeted people are no longer citizens with rights. They become defective tissue to be managed or removed.
And the danger of this medicalized view of society doesn't stop with eugenics.
Hmm.
The text dives deeply into the concept of normalization,
which is much more subtle, but everywhere.
It cites thinkers like Michel Foucault on disciplinary power, When you apply a medical model to society, you inevitably have to establish a norm.
Yes, and this is where it gets very pervasive. Think about how we decide what a normal attention span is for a child in a classroom.
Okay, yeah.
We take a statistical average of how long a child can sit still at a desk. Once we define that statistical average as healthy and normal, anyone who falls outside of it isn't just seen as having a different temperament or learning style.
They are suddenly diagnosed as defective. They have a pathology.
This is exactly what disability scholarship focuses on. The text brings up writers like Alison Kafer and Eli Clare.
Yes, they argue powerfully against the tyranny of the cure narrative.
Exactly. When a society is obsessed with a very narrow definition of health, it forces a cure narrative onto people whose body or minds operate differently.
It tells them your existence is a problem to be fixed.
Rather than recognizing that neurodivergence or physical disability is a valuable inherent part of human diversity, if a civilization is obsessed with achieving a singular state of health, it might look at cultural difference, neurodivergence, or even political dissent and diagnose them as an inflammation that needs to be suppressed.
It's the ultimate excuse for social engineering, which the paper also covers, referencing the political scientist James C. Scott and his concept of high modernist paternalism.
This is a classic pattern in the 20th century.
What does that mean exactly?
High modernist paternalism is when elites, often sitting in offices in capital cities, armed with these grand theories and maps, look out at a complex, messy local reality and decide they are going to cure it.
Right.
They impose these massive, simplified administrative schemes on local populations without their consent.
Like deciding to build a massive hydroelectric dam to modernize a region, completely ignoring the fact that it will flood ancestral lands, destroy local agriculture, and displace thousands of people.
Exactly. Because the elites view themselves as the objective healers and the local population as the ignorant patients who just don't know what's good for them.
If the patient screams while the surgeon cuts, the surgeon just ignores it as a necessary part of the cure.
It's a terrifying mindset.
There's one more danger the text highlights, and I see this happening constantly in modern political discourse today. Ideological capture.
Oh, yes. This is crucial.
This is when the language of healing is used to actively suppress the demand for justice.
It happens so often in post-conflict situations or in highly unequal societies. The powerful group or the state will appropriate the language of wellness. They will say to a marginalized or oppressed group, hey, we are one nation. We need to reconcile. We need to heal our divisions and move forward together.
Which, I mean, that sounds lovely on television.
It sounds wonderful until you realize what it's actually doing. It demands that the harmed group let go of their anger and reconcile before the state delivers truth, restitution, or structural change.
It recodes a legitimate political demand for justice into an emotional psychological wound that the victim just needs to, you know, get over.
Exactly. It tells the marginalized group to heal while ensuring the power arrangements that produce the harm in the first place stay exactly the same.
So if you combine all of this, eugenics, forced normalization, high modernist social engineering, and the suppression of justice, the ultimate danger is what the author calls totalization.
Right. If your goal is a permanently, perfectly healthy civilization, you are seeking a final, unquestionable, unified order.
And in a perfectly unified order, plurality, tragedy, friction, and conflict all become defects. It absorbs every domain of human life and leaves no room for someone to stand up and say, no, I disagree with your diagnosis of how we should live.
It becomes a totalitarian nightmare.
Okay, I have to stop here because I am reading all of this and I'm nodding along realizing how dangerous the healing metaphor is. But then I'm looking at the title of the author's larger project, which is literally civilizational healing.
I know, it feels like a contradiction.
If the concept has historically led to forced sterilization, totalitarianism, silencing marginalized groups, and viewing dissenters as pathogens, why use the word at all?
It is the most vital question we can ask.
Why not just call the book The Missing Grammar of Modern Repair or Systemic Correction? Why hold on to a word so soaked in blood?
Why risk it? Well, the author argues that we have to reclaim a specific, reconstructed version of this grammar because we simply cannot abandon normativity entirely.
Okay, let's define normativity for you listening, just so we don't lose anyone.
Normativity simply means having a standard of what is good or bad, what is desirable or undesirable, what is healthy or harmful. It is the ability to make a value judgment.
Okay.
In recent decades, especially in critical theory, there has been a strong push to say, well, all values are subjective. Imposing norms is oppressive. Let's just refuse to define a universal good.
Which sounds like a great way to avoid becoming a dictator. Just let everyone decide for themselves.
It sounds safe, but the author points out a devastating reality. If you abandon normativity, you do not actually get neutrality. You just create a massive power vacuum.
And what fills that vacuum?
It is immediately filled by mechanisms that are least visible as moral authorities, but incredibly powerful in practice.
Oh, like if the people refuse to define what a good society looks like, the market will just define it for them.
Exactly. Market prices will define the good. Algorithmic engagement metrics will define the good. Bureaucratic default settings will define the good.
We cannot just surrender the definition of human flourishing to an automated spreadsheet.
We need a standard. We need a way to say this ecological collapse is bad and this community health is good, but we need a standard that has built-in immune defenses against becoming a totalitarian nightmare.
We need to thread an impossibly tiny needle.
Yes. And the text provides a framework for this. It calls it post-totalizing civilizational normativity.
Post-totalizing normativity. Okay, let's break down how that actually works in practice, because this is basically the blueprint for how we survive. The text lays out a specific architecture to make sure our desire to heal doesn't become tyrannical.
There are a few crucial layers to this. First, the normativity must be thicket thresholds.
Thicket thresholds, meaning there's a hard, non-negotiable floor.
Exactly. You cannot have endless relativity when it comes to basic survival. There is a firm floor of human rights and planetary boundaries that must be maintained.
The bodily security, freedom from domination, access to food and clean water.
And the preservation of ecological systems that support life. These are not trade-offs.
You can't say, well, the economy grew by 8% this quarter, so it's perfectly acceptable that we poisoned this river and oppressed this minority group.
No. The threshold is thick. It cannot be crossed. But here's the second layer. Above that thick threshold, the society must be plural in flourishing.
So once everyone has basic rights and the planet isn't burning, the state stops telling you how to live.
Precisely. We don't dictate what a good life looks like. We don't force one religion, one family structure, or one cultural ideal.
As long as you aren't violating the rights floor or the ecological boundaries, communities can pursue vastly different ways of living and organizing themselves.
It is open to plurality.
And the third layer is about how we revise these rules, right? It must be fallibilist in revision.
Fallibilism is the philosophical principle that human beings could be wrong about their beliefs, expectations, or understanding of the world.
Meaning we are fallible.
Exactly. Therefore, every diagnosis, every policy, and every model must be treated as inherently revisable.
We have to build institutions that have the humility to say, hey, we thought this policy was healing the community, but new data shows it's hurting people, so we are going to change it.
We have to preserve dissenting views and keep records of our failures just in case our current cure turns out to be toxic.
So let's look at the theoretical structure we've built here. We diagnose the problem-organized irresponsibility across our specialized silos.
We rejected the fake unity of appropriating ancient wisdom without context.
We navigated the historical nightmare of treating society like a biological body. And we arrived at a solution, a shared grammar of civilizational healing that connects our silos using post-totalizing normativity.
Thick on basic rights, open to diverse ways of living, and always willing to admit it's wrong.
It is a brilliant theoretical architecture. We have the theory. But theory is about to collide violently with the physical reality of the 21st century.
Yes, it is.
Because theory is about to meet the most powerful translating engine humanity has ever built. Artificial intelligence.
This is where the text pivots from philosophy to urgent contemporary reality.
In this deep dive, AI is not just a side note. It isn't just a cool tech gadget. The author identifies AI as the historical hinge upon which all of this turns.
And when you think about it, that makes perfect sense. AI is rapidly becoming the infrastructure that mediates all of the isolated silos we've been talking about.
Science, law, medicine, finance, logistics, they're all being fundamentally rewired by machine learning models.
Large language models can synthesize dispersed documents and translate between different professional jargons. Algorithmic systems are classifying patients in hospitals, pricing risks in insurance markets, modeling climate scenarios, and sorting job applicants.
AI sits exactly at the interface of all our fragmented systems.
It really does.
It is the ultimate translating machine. It could be the connective tissue that finally provides that shared grammar we need. But I mean, right now, that is not what it's doing.
Not at all.
Right now, AI is acting as a massive amplifier of subsystem optimization. It's taking the silos, making them incredibly fast, incredibly efficient, and somehow even more blind to the bigger picture.
That is the profound danger we are facing. Most deployed AI today is commissioned by a specific institution to improve a highly bounded, narrow objective.
Like what?
An agricultural company trains an AI to maximize crop yield per acre. A bank trains an AI to reduce processing time for loan approvals. A social media platform trains an algorithm to maximize human attention and engagement time.
And the AI doesn't care about anything outside of that assigned proxy metric.
Exactly. And the text provides a canonical, chilling example of what happens when you let an AI optimize a narrow proxy metric within a siloed institution. We really have to look closely at the Obermeyer healthcare algorithm.
This story is the perfect encapsulation of everything we've talked about so far. Tell us how this algorithm worked and how it failed so spectacularly.
So this was a widely used algorithm deployed by hospitals and health systems in the United States. And the goal was actually very well-intentioned.
Okay.
Hospitals have limited resources, specifically specialized care programs for high-risk, chronically ill patients. They wanted an objective, data-driven way to predict which patients were going to need extra medical care in the future so they could proactively allocate resources to help them.
That sounds like a perfect use case for AI. Let the machine read the data and tell us who needs help.
Right. But to build a machine learning model, you have to give it a measurable mathematical target to predict. You can't just tell an AI, predict who will be sick.
Because sick is a subjective, complex human state.
Exactly. You need a quantifiable proxy. So the developers chose a proxy metric that seemed completely logical: healthcare costs.
The assumption being that if a patient costs the hospital a lot of money, they must have greater health needs. Sick people cost more to treat than healthy people. On paper, that makes perfect sense.
But the AI was trained on historical data. And historically, because of unequal access to care, lack of insurance, geographic disparities, and systemic racism within the medical system, society spent significantly less money on Black patients than it did on white patients with the exact same level of biological illness.
Wow. So because the system was broken, the data reflected a broken reality.
Exactly. So the algorithm looks at millions of historical records. It sees that Black patients historically generate lower costs. And because its proxy metric is cost, the algorithm mathematically concludes Black patients don't cost as much, therefore they must not be as sick.
So when the hospitals ran the AI on current patients, what happened?
The algorithm severely underestimated the medical needs of Black patients. A Black patient would have to be significantly sicker, experiencing far more acute biological distress, than a white patient to receive the same algorithmic risk score that qualified them for the extra care program.
That is devastating.
The algorithm perfectly optimized its proxy metric predicting cost while catastrophically failing its actual institutional purpose predicting human health needs.
The model was incredibly accurate at predicting the math, but the institution's category was fatally flawed. And the truly scary part of this is how automation launders authority.
That is a crucial phrase, laundering authority.
Think about it. If a hospital administrator stood up in a meeting and said, "Hey, we are implementing a new policy. We're going to allocate fewer specialized resources to Black patients," there would be mass protests.
They would be fired immediately.
Right. But when a multi-million dollar AI system outputs a sterile digital spreadsheet where a Black patient has a risk score of 4.2 and a white patient has a risk score of 8.9, nobody questions it.
It looks like a neutral mathematical fact.
The historical inequality is disguised as objective data.
That is the core risk of AI acting as an optimization technology. It takes a local, flawed simplification, strips away the human context, and scales it into a vast, unquestionable infrastructure.
It perfectly optimizes the proxy within its silo and completely ignores all the externalities, like the suffering of the misclassified patients.
And we also have to talk about the externalities of the AI itself.
Oh, definitely. The text makes a point that I think gets lost in a lot of tech hype. We talk about AI like it's this ethereal, magical force living in the cloud.
But the cloud is heavy.
The cloud is made of concrete, steel, rare earth minerals, and massive, massive amounts of electricity and water.
The material footprint of AI is staggering. The paper cites projections from the International Energy Agency, which estimates that global data center electricity use could more than double by 2030, driven in massive part by the computational demands of training and running AI models.
Which violates a core principle of civilizational healing, the principle of non-displacement.
How so?
If a tech CEO claims their new AI system is going to heal the planet by optimizing smart grids, But the energy required to train that AI is keeping coal plants running and polluting a community halfway across the world. You haven't healed anything.
You've just displaced the burden.
You've hidden the injury.
This brings us to what is arguably the most important conceptual distinction in this entire section of the text. The author introduces two incredibly useful terms to help us understand what we are dealing with. System intelligence versus civilizational intelligence.
If you are taking notes on this deep dive, circle this distinction. It is everything. Break it down for us.
System intelligence is the capacity to optimize effectively within a bounded domain. It is what engineers call single-loop learning.
Single-loop learning, meaning it asks, how do I do this assigned task faster and better?
Exactly. A high-frequency financial trading algorithm, a military logistics network, a recommendation engine on a video app. These possess incredibly high system intelligence. They are extraordinarily capable of hitting their assigned target.
But they have absolutely zero civilizational intelligence.
Yes, because civilizational intelligence is double-loop learning.
Double-loop learning.
Civilizational intelligence has the self-awareness and the capacity to ask, wait, is this target actually the right goal? Should we even be doing this task at all?
It is the capacity of a society to perceive how all these different systems interact and affect life as a whole.
Can the society hear the suffering caused by the algorithm?
Mm-hmm.
Can it integrate evidence across different silos? Can it revise its proxy metrics when harms occur?
Let me give you an analogy that helped me completely internalize this concept.
Yeah.
It is the difference between a self-driving car and a city planner.
Oh, that's a good one. Let's hear it.
So system intelligence is the self-driving car. You get in and you tell it, get me to work 5 minutes faster. That is its proxy metric. The car uses its massive computational power, analyzes traffic patterns, and calculates an optimal route. It decides to bypass the highway and cut straight through a quiet residential neighborhood at 45 miles an hour. It succeeds perfectly. You get to work 5 minutes faster. It optimized the proxy.
But at what cost?
Exactly. Now imagine thousands of self-driving cars all making the same calculation. They are all cutting through this neighborhood. They have completely destroyed the safety, the peace, and the air quality of that community. Kids can't play outside anymore.
The self-driving cars possess incredible system intelligence, but they are destroying the city.
Right. So civilizational intelligence is the city planner stepping in and asking, wait, why are we prioritizing 5 minutes of commute time over the safety of a neighborhood? Is our metric wrong?
Instead of optimizing cars, should we change the zoning laws so people live closer to their jobs?
Or should we build a light rail system so people don't need cars in the first place?
Yeah.
System intelligence drives the car perfectly. Civilizational intelligence asks if we should be driving at all.
That is a phenomenal analogy. And it raises the most urgent question of our era. How do we govern AI so that it acts as the infrastructure for the city planner, rather than just acting as the engine for millions of blind self-driving cars?
Because right now, all the financial incentives, the billions of dollars pouring into tech companies, are pushing purely towards system intelligence.
It is highly profitable to build an algorithm that optimizes clicks or cuts supply chain costs. It is much harder to build an infrastructure for double-loop learning.
But the text argues that it is possible. The paper actually outlines 7 specific reflexive functions that AI could support if we govern it correctly.
It's basically a roadmap for how AI could become the connective tissue, the shared grammar between our broken silos.
Let's go through them.
To understand how these functions work, let's look at them applied to a complex real-world crisis. Let's go back to our earlier scenario of the coastal city dealing with a failing coal plant, a dying fishing industry, and rising asthma rates.
Okay, where the city's paralyzed because the economists, the doctors, and the ecologists can't talk to each other.
Right. How does AI help them? The first thing AI does is act as a universal translator. This is the first function cross-domain synthesis.
Because AI can ingest millions of incompatible data sets, right?
Exactly. PDFs from the Environmental Protection Agency, unstructured community testimonies from town hall meetings, raw epidemiological spreadsheets from hospital billing departments, and it can map the semantic relationships between them.
It can build a traceable evidence map showing exactly how a specific change in water toxicity regulations will likely impact the local fading economy and how that will subsequently impact community health.
And crucially, it doesn't force a fake consensus. It can explicitly highlight where the economic model and the ecological model fundamentally disagree.
Then it helps the city look into the future. That is the second function, anticipatory modeling.
Right. Instead of the mayor just guessing or listening to whichever lobbyist is shouting the loudest, the AI can help the community generate multiple inspectable scenarios.
Like, if we shut the plant down in 2 years and redirect funds to green tech, here are the likely outcomes across health, jobs, and ecology. If we wait 10 years, here are the alternative outcomes.
It makes the invisible trade-offs visible to everyone. The third function is incredibly vital for accountability institutional memory.
Oh, this is a big one. Bureaucracies are notorious for their amnesia.
They constantly lose the reasons for their past decisions. They repeat failed pilot programs. And most insidiously, they often accidentally lose the paperwork when a marginalized community submits a complaint about pollution or harm.
AI can serve as an unerasable provenance-linked ledger. It remembers the null findings, it remembers the warnings that were ignored. It holds the institution accountable to its own history.
Which leads directly into the fourth function, early warning, and anomaly detection.
Because AI is so good at pattern recognition, it can see a crisis forming across silos long before any single human expert could.
It can detect that a slight rise in a specific chemical purchased by a factory correlates with a spike in a rare respiratory symptom at a local clinic, catching a public health crisis before it explodes.
But the text is very careful to warn that this early warning must trigger support and investigation, not preemptive policing or surveillance. We don't want a minority report situation.
Absolutely not. The fifth function uses AI for causal contestation, or what cybersecurity experts call red teaming.
I love this one. It's like an institutionalized devil's advocate.
Yes. When the powerful stakeholders present their perfect plan to transition the city, an independent AI system can be used to aggressively challenge the dominant narrative.
It can run rival hypotheses. It can say, hey, have you considered how this new zoning law will displace this specific vulnerable group that you omitted from your primary data set?
It empowers marginalized voices with rigorous data-driven counterarguments, which empowers the public to actually participate. That rests function six deliberative scaffolding.
I think about those 2,000-page environmental impact reports that developers release. No normal citizen has the time or the technical expertise to read that and debate it at a city council meeting.
No, of course not. But AI can synthesize that dense technical evidence, translate it into accessible language, create visualizations, and level the playing field so democracy can actually function.
And finally, the seventh function is recursive evaluation. This is how we combat Campbell's Law.
Remind us exactly how Campbell's Law works, because it explains so much about why our institutions fail.
Campbell's Law is a sociological principle that states the more a quantitative indicator is used for social decision-making, the more subject it will be to corruption pressures, and the more it will distort the very process it is meant to monitor.
Once a proxy metric becomes a target, it ceases to be a good metric.
Exactly. Think about standardized testing in schools. The goal is to evaluate if students are learning. The proxy metric is the test score. Once the test score becomes the target, meaning school funding and teacher salaries depend on it, the institution starts teaching to the test.
They might even cheat. Test scores go up, but the actual quality of education plummets.
AI can help us recursively track our policies over long time frames to see if our metrics are failing us. Did the policy actually heal the community, or did the institution just figure out how to hit the proxy number?
Okay, so if we implement these seven functions, translation, modeling, memory, early warning, red teaming, public scaffolding, and recursive evaluation, AI becomes the most incredible tool for civilizational intelligence imaginable.
It sounds like AI is going to do all the heavy lifting. We can just hand the keys over to the machine and let it heal us?
No, absolutely, unequivocally no. The author draws a massive bright red line here. We cannot position AI as the healer.
AI is the infrastructure. It is not the agent.
Exactly. The text references the pioneering computer scientist Joseph Weizenbaum, who wrote a book back in 1976 about the limits of artificial intelligence. He made a crucial distinction between calculation and judgment.
It is a distinction we are rapidly forgetting today. A machine can calculate probability, can map complex patterns, it can synthesize millions of documents, but it cannot exercise judgment.
The text actually lists specific non-delegable human tasks. These are things that AI can never do, no matter how advanced the neural network becomes.
Like what?
AI can map value conflicts, but it can never authoritatively define the good. It cannot grant political legitimacy. A statistical prediction, no matter how accurate, is not the same thing as democratic authorization.
And AI cannot recognize moral standing. Because a machine does not possess a body, it does not suffer.
It cannot mourn a loss. It cannot consent to a sacrifice. It owes no historical reparations. Therefore, it is entirely incapable of accepting moral or political responsibility.
When an AI makes a mistake that destroys a life, the AI does not feel guilt, and you cannot put an algorithm in jail.
And crucially, AI cannot decide when not to optimize. Sometimes a healthy society requires friction. It requires ambiguity. It requires slowness or privacy.
The choice to deliberately not use technology, to step back from optimization, is a profoundly human judgment.
If we just rely on having a human in the loop, which usually just means an overworked employee rubber stamping the AI's output under extreme time pressure, that is nowhere near enough.
The author insists that we don't just need a human in the loop. We need society and the purpose loop, the boundary loop, and the revision loop.
The affected communities must participate in defining the problem before the AI is even turned on.
So how on earth do we guarantee that? Because right now, the reality is that 3 or 4 massive tech megacorporations essentially own and control all of this infrastructure.
If we rely on them, we are just outsourcing our civilizational intelligence to their profit margins.
The text lays out some very concrete, demanding governance requirements to keep AI serving the public good. Let's go through them.
First, we need independent end-to-end auditing. This doesn't just mean a quick safety test before the model is released to make sure it doesn't output hate speech. It means continuous auditing across its entire life cycle.
How is the AI actually interacting with human institutions in the wild? When it inevitably fails or misclassifies someone who holds the legal liability?
Second, we need public capability.
This is critical. If cross-domain synthesis and institutional memory are going to become the core infrastructure of our civilization, we cannot be entirely dependent on a few private tech firms to rent that infrastructure to us.
That is a constitutional crisis waiting to happen. The public sector, democratic governments, and independent research universities must have secure public interest computing power.
And third, we need profound changes to data governance. We have to stop treating data like it's just raw material sitting out in the wild waiting to be extracted by a tech company.
The text specifically highlights indigenous data sovereignty and the CARE principles,
which stand for collective benefit, authority to control, responsibility, and ethics.
Data is a record of human relationships, histories, and bodies. Communities, especially marginalized groups who are most often harmed by algorithmic bias, must have the right to refuse extraction.
They must have the authority to control how their data is used and ensure it is used for their collective benefit, not just for corporate training models.
And my absolute favorite governance rule from the text: pre-designed stop rules and decommissioning protocols.
A system that cannot be safely turned off is an ungovernable system.
Before we ever deploy a massive AI system into a hospital or a legal bureaucracy, we have to establish the exact metrics that will trigger an automatic shutdown if it starts causing harm. We need an emergency brake.
When you combine all of these governance requirements, auditing, public capability, data sovereignty, and stop rules, it completely transforms what we mean by responsible AI.
Today, responsible AI usually just means a corporate PR campaign ensuring the chatbot is polite.
In the framework of civilizational healing, responsible AI means the technology is deeply embedded in an institutional relationship where power, purpose, consequences, and human liability remain inextricably linked over time.
Okay, we have covered an immense amount of ground today.
Let's trace our path one last time. We diagnosed the profound grammar deficit of our fragmented modern world, where the surgeon, the lawyer, and the engineer are all succeeding while the patient dies.
We explored why we can't just slap ancient, out-of-context wisdom onto modern problems.
We navigated the incredibly dark, dangerous history of treating society like a body to be cured, looking at eugenics and forced normalization.
We mapped out a post-totalizing normativity that protects basic rights while allowing for diverse ways of living.
And we just outlined exactly how AI can serve as the reflexive infrastructure to bind our civilization back together without dominating it.
It is a massive, incredibly rigorous intellectual architecture.
So let's synthesize this. Let's pull it all together for you, the listener. What does this all mean for your life, your community, your industry?
What is the ultimate endpoint of applying this grammar and building this AI infrastructure?
If we do all of this perfectly, are we finally going to achieve a perfectly healthy civilization?
No, we are not. And that is perhaps the most profound and important takeaway of this entire deep dive. The goal is not to achieve a healthy civilization.
Which sounds completely counterintuitive given that the author's larger project is literally called civilizational healing.
It does sound like a contradiction, mm-hmm. but as we discussed when looking at the history of eugenics and totalitarianism, the idea of a permanently healthy, finished, perfect society is a dangerous, violent fantasy.
It implies an end to conflict. It implies perfect equilibrium where everyone agrees.
But a living human society is incredibly messy. It is full of deep, intractable disagreements. It constantly faces tragic choices where there is no perfect, painless answer.
And critically, a living society experiences irreversible losses. A species that goes extinct due to climate change cannot be brought back.
A community destroyed by industrial pollution carries generational trauma that cannot just be erased. The goal isn't to pretend we can cure everything and return to some pure, unblemished state of health.
The goal isn't a healthy civilization. The goal is a civilization capable of healing.
Precisely. It is about corrigibility with capacity. A civilization that can detect an injury early before it cascades into a planetary crisis.
A civilization that has the institutional sensitivity to hear the voices of those who are suffering, even if their pain doesn't fit neatly into the official bureaucratic data.
A society that can trace systemic causes across our specialized silos, integrate different kinds of knowledge, distribute accountability fairly, and actually adapt its behavior.
It is an ongoing, dynamic, never-ending process. It is a capacity, not a final destination.
It is the ability to learn from reality, to engage in double-loop learning, and to change course when we realize we are causing harm.
Which brings me to a final, truly provocative thought from the text that I want to leave you with today. It's a something for you to mull over as you navigate your own world, whether that's in a corporate boardroom, a city council meeting, or just within your own family.
The author points out that because some losses are irreversible and because true healing is not about returning to a pristine state, there are some scars that should remain in public memory.
We should not try to cure or erase them, because a scar is proof that a severe injury occurred. A scar is a structural reminder of a failure we must never repeat.
So I want you to look around your own community or your own industry today.
What is a scar or a deep conflict that we shouldn't try to pave over with forced, superficial wellness or smooth out with a highly optimized AI algorithm?
What is a piece of friction, a lingering discomfort, or an unresolved memory of injustice that we actually need to keep around?
What must we hold on to keep our society awake, accountable, and truly capable of healing in the future?
That is the ultimate question of civilizational intelligence. In a world obsessed with optimization and moving fast, what do we actually need to remember in order to survive?
Thank you for taking this incredibly deep journey into the missing grammar of modern civilization with us. Until next time, keep asking the hard questions.